Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. Today I'm joined with Michelle Desjardins, who is a scholar of religious studies at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. His most recent work is focused on religion and food, but some of his previous research is also focused on Christian origins within the academic study of religion, as well as Gnosticism. So I'd just like to give you a warm welcome, Dr. Desjardins.
Thanks, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, I guess let's just jump right into the nitty-gritty. So what do you think the study of food and religion entails or covers? What do you think is the connections between the two?
Well, it covers an awful lot. If you look at living religious individuals around the world and you make the connection between however they imagine their spirituality and food, then there are an awful lot of links. For example, there are some religious individuals who, for religious reasons, will not eat particular kinds of food. And so it can be vegetarian lifestyle, it can be certain kinds of meats are forbidden, the kinds of things that we well know about Jews and Muslims and so forth. So there are food restrictions that are there, that are built into a lot of religious traditions, and sometimes ones that you wouldn't expect, actually. So there's some Christian traditions, for example, that are vegetarian that people don't know very much about. But the one angle is what you can eat and what you can't eat. And I suppose a variation of that is what you can eat and what you can't eat at certain times of the year or certain times of the month. So, you know, fasts that people do at particular moments for various reasons across religious traditions. So again, that's a variation of particular food restrictions that people impose on themselves for religious reasons. There are also all kinds of ways in which people reach out to the spirit world, to the gods, through food. So whether it's food offerings or food sacrifices, whether it's to the good spirits, including the ancestors, or the bad spirits to keep them away, there's lots of that engagement with the divine through food, and really a really good example of that most people are aware of if they think about it for a moment is the Roman Catholic Christian tradition, where people ingest God when they go to communion. So in fact, you communicate with Jesus, you communicate with God by eating God. And so there's a very deep sense there. I mean, you may pray to God, but you actually take God into your body through food. So there's that kind of link too, with reaching out through food. There are maybe less direct ways, like food charity. So there are virtually all religious traditions, maybe not Buddhism, for the most part, virtually all religious traditions express their religiosity through helping others. And a major form of helping others is food. And one example of that in my country, and I'm sure also in other parts of the world, are food banks that are there to address the needs of the poor. And in Canada, a huge percentage of those food banks either were set up by Christian groups or are continuing to be managed by Christian groups. And that's being developed now that, you know, the more Muslims we have, the more Muslim food banks there are. And so that's a form, too, of connecting food charity, in this case, with a religious tradition. There's also people eating together in the context of a religious ceremony. So virtually every religious tradition has situations where you celebrate your tradition by food. So the food brings people together, commensality, as some people call it. And that's not incidental, I think. You know, I've interviewed people and told them to tell me about particular religious feasts that they remember, and the first thing that comes to their mind is a taste or a smell, not a sermon or a dogma. And so I think people often connect religious festivals to food very, very directly. And then there's, you know, prayer said over food, and there's a variety of other ways in which food is connected to people's spirituality.
Well, it's really interesting. So what initially got you interested in studying food and religion?
That's a good question. You know, when you look back, when any of us looks back on why we happen to be doing a particular thing at a particular moment. There are a lot of factors, I think, leading up to it. And I thought of that myself, and some of the reasons are idiosyncratic, and some of them are a bit more profound, I think. Some of them have to do with something I wanted to add, and some have to do with a lack. I've long been struck in the study of religion by how, as scholars, we look at particular facets of religion and we ignore others. And we all know that the field was developed predominantly by Christians and predominantly by Protestant Christians. And so it's not surprising that even with the best of intentions and the openness of spirit, it's not surprising that people would have conceptualized the study of religion in terms that matter to that form or those forms of religion. And it just so happens, idiosyncratically, I suppose, but maybe more profoundly, it just so happens that Protestant forms of Christianity pay the least attention to food of all religious traditions in the universe, even if there's some in Mars. So there, that question really interests me a lot, and we may want to come back to it later, but the question of what happened in Protestant Christianity that food restrictions, fasting, deep food concerns with spirituality have been removed for the most part. And so I've long been interested in what's not there in the study of religion. And that question has been approached by a lot of others as well. I mean, we know that 30 years ago, people started to ask in more significant ways the question of what about the women? And that transformed our field. Because suddenly, once that question gets asked, you can't go back anymore and study religion the way it was studied. And for me, it's been that way with food. When I seriously asked the question about food as a major marker for religious people, it's impossible to go back once that barrier is broken, because virtually everywhere you go, and it's not just me in this case, if you put the spotlight on people being religious, you have a lot of interactions with food. So I think part of my interest comes from being a scholar of religion and being interested, I think, in knowing more about religious individuals. That's why I'm a scholar of religion. I think that religion can tell us something about human beings, and religion is a good place to start thinking about humans. And so what the study of religion decides to focus on matters a lot in terms of the data you're going to get. A second reason is I was caught up, I mentioned a minute ago, I was caught up in the study of religion, what about the women issue in the late 80s for me. I came on maybe 5 or 6 years later than the beginning of that wave. And I was struck by over the years how people have asked the question of what about the women. And it's long seemed to me that yes, we need to ask the question about what about the women who wrote the texts? What about the women who were the leaders in the communities? But it struck me that we're not asking the questions about what about the women who are raising the kids at home and making them religious? What about the women who are, in this particular case, preparing the food that's so vital to religious communities? And so I think that by turning the spotlight on more mundane activities and giving those mundane activities importance, not just incidental importance, but importance, the question of what about the women sometimes even gets spun around, and the question becomes, where are the men? Because if you have such a foundational element to religion as food, and you know, one can make the same argument about children, the question there is, why aren't there more men involved in the food issues related to religion? So for me, it was a liberating kind of moment when I thought, well, I can focus on gender issues that have become important to me by turning the spotlight on other issues rather than looking for where the women leaders were in the past, because other people have done that better than I can. And then there was a pragmatic reason is several years ago, I had a long conversation with my wife, who's spent 25 years of her life being a community nutritionist. And she was talking about her field, working with the public, and I was talking about my field. And it turned out in this long walk that we had together that we had similar directions that we wanted our research to go. And we thought, how cool would it be to actually work together on a project in the latter part of our lives. So we developed the Food and Religion Project thinking that this would bring us together. And for me, it mattered for another reason as well. And that's that over time, I've become more sensitive to the fact that if you do field work, you're much better off doing field work with somebody else or with a group of people, because we all bring particular perspectives to the material. And it's been a revelation to me to do field work with Ellen, because we're very different people, and we'll be in situations, not only will she be able to go into places that I can't, you know, kitchens sometimes, but she will ask questions that I would never think of asking, and vice versa. So sometimes I'll transcribe the interviews, and we've done over 200 of these now, but sometimes I'll transcribe them. And, you know, when she asked the question in the interview format, I was thinking to myself, or I might have been thinking to myself, that's a strange question to ask. And then when I'm transcribing it, I realize the value of that question, you know, that, and it's been fantastic working together. So the hunch that we had that we could bring different expertise to the table has turned out to be correct. And I mean, it could have been a disaster in the end, but it was an experiment we did by working together. And then I suppose, just to add a point to your question of why get into something like this, once I started to get into it, I saw two things happen. One was my colleagues, and by that I mean not only people that I work with at this university, but in conferences I went to, I found that they responded to this topic that I was interested in with bemusement. It's almost like they would say, well, that's interesting, you know, I have a cookbook that deals with this, and, well, I have a recipe I can share with you. And I was frankly shocked by that response, because when in the years when I have, you know, talked about quote unquote important issues like academic study, religion, or, you know, what does the New Testament gospel say about X, people took that very seriously because it's quote unquote a serious topic. But as soon as I was talking about food, I felt that they were trivializing my research. And if I would have been 20 years old, I think I would have felt a bit threatened by that. But in my position, it served the opposite function. It made me think, hey, there's something here that needs to be explored because people aren't getting it. So it spurred me on in a way that otherwise it might not have. And then I also found, conversely, that in my classes when I started to bring this information out, people were amazed and excited, right? So the teaching became a lot more fun. And I found that once the word got out that I was doing the research, the community around me, which ranged from church groups to mosques to old folks' homes, asked me to come and talk about it. So I suddenly felt like on a regular person level, the topic hit something, and it was amazing. And at the university, it hit something with students, and it hit a little bit of a wall with academics. And so that was fantastic. That, again, spurred my interest and made me think this is worth doing.
You kind of lead me to another question, which is related to methodology. You mentioned you did interviews. What were some of the ways you collected data related to food and religion?
That's a good question. You introduced me by saying I've done previous work in Christian origins and Gnosticism and in academic study of religion, and those areas were very textually based, and a lot of them had to do with the past. So I was trained as a scholar who knows all these old languages that nobody else knows and does historical study of the past. So I had to retrain myself as an anthropologist, essentially, which is so exciting, because to come to an area later in my career and to be asking the kinds of critical questions that I asked as a textual scholar. In other words, you know, I'm collecting data, and if I ask different questions, suddenly I get different data. It's data I can go and ask the person again. So to me, it was a world of wonders that I had talked about with students, but I'd never experienced myself. And my wife had done years of interviewing, and she'd been very rigorous about this in her work, had used Envivo to crunch the results and so forth and to break stuff down. And so we ended up doing semi-structured interviews, the kind of thing that everyone says. And we experimented a fair bit with the kinds of, because I was learning how to do it. So it became a lot of fun approaching things from different perspectives and seeing the results that we would get. And Ellen crunched the data. I did transcriptions because I learned so much by doing transcriptions. And then Ellen crunched the data with NVivo. And then I started to see the wonder of using a source like that for unpacking data. So we went about it that way. And initially, we gave ourselves, this was a sabbatical year for me way back, and we gave ourselves a year to do preliminary analysis of what kinds of answers people gave us when we approached them with, you know, 10 questions of what's the first thing that comes to mind when we say food and religion, et cetera, et cetera. And though that preliminary year turned out to be 5 and 6 years, because it turned out, obviously, the questions too broad, the material that we gathered became more and more interesting. We traveled around the world, literally every moment we could get. We would go to a different place. We would go to different locations in Canada and the U.S. And everywhere we could, we would see what people had to say. So it became this exploration that continued for a while. And like any kind of grounded theory, at some point when you ask enough people about food charity or enough people about Eid al-Adha, for instance, in Islam, you realize that you've got enough answers because people start repeating things, right? You get interesting answers nonetheless, but you start repeating. So we asked questions until we felt that we had naturally the themes that emerged, some of which I mentioned at the beginning. And then we asked those questions until we felt that the themes, we knew enough about the themes to fairly represent them.
Okay. Well, sort of looking at specific religions now, for example, you mentioned both Catholicism and, to some degree, the Indian traditions. You know, with the Indian, you know, Indian religions being so food-centric, and given that the Catholic, you know, given the Catholic Eucharist, why has food not really been a central concern for academic study in religion?
Well, that's a key question. You know, when I, let me approach it from one angle, Chris. When I look at the literature on the data on this topic, and when I started it, I did an exhaustive search of what was out there. It turned out that, and I'm generalizing a bit, but it turned out that 40% of the information was written on Hindu forms of religion, and 40% was written by Jews about Jewish forms of religion. So Jews got the food thing, and Hindus, most of the people writing about Hinduism were Hindus, Hindus got the food thing, and virtually nobody else did. I mean, there's some religious traditions like Jains that are very food-centric, but there aren't a lot of people writing about that within that tradition or about the Jains with that in mind. So the literature is predominantly Hindu-based and Jewish-based. There's also a fair bit of literature by people who want to advocate vegetarianism in different ways. And so sometimes those people are religious individuals, and sometimes they're secular people who want to use various religious traditions like Buddhism or forms of Hinduism, Jainism, to point to the value of vegetarianism. So that's part of the area that becomes a bit contentious for individuals. So I think one of the reasons that people don't say more about food and religion is because there's not a lot written on it. And it tends to be focused in those two broad traditions. And as I said earlier, I think for the Protestant Christians, which represent a good number of people doing the study of religion, it's not really that important, or people don't get it. And, you know, you mentioned Catholicism. You wouldn't believe the number of times when we ask Catholics about the Eucharist, and they say, oh, but that's not food. It's the strangest thing. And we say, well, yeah, but it's a host or it's a piece of bread. And no, but that's not food. That's the Eucharist. So asking those questions about food and religion sometimes forces a Catholic to say, well, that has nothing to do with me. Thank you very much. Or sometimes it'll make a Catholic who's very much into charity say, well, that's charity. That's not religion, in a kind of curious way. So people sometimes essentialize religion to something that excludes food. And Catholics can be good at doing that, and Protestants do it as well. And so I think that it falls off the plate. And Muslims, for very interesting reasons, also have a lot to say about food restrictions, but there's not a lot of Muslims who approach Islam through the lens of food, so strangely enough. So there's the classic ways of doing it. I mean, you know the intro books on Islam. Show me one that has a section on food, right? It's absent. There might be something on fasting, but in the context of the requirements, not in the context of food. There might be a section on the Hajj, but there's nothing there about the animal sacrifice that happens in the Hajj, except incidentally, there's a reference to it, as though that's not important. So it's very, very curious. You know, I had, for instance, I was in conversation with somebody who was writing on ancient forms of human and animal sacrifice. And they said, well, is there something you could point me to? And I said, well, how about Eid al-Adha or Qurban in Islam? And they said, well, what's that? And I said, well, it's the largest living sacrifice ceremony in the world. I said, there's probably at least a half a billion Muslims who are involved in the celebration every year, and it involves the killing of an animal, et cetera, et cetera. Even that is, you know, should be put out for people who are studying religion.
So what about, who are some of the key scholars that you would find in this area?
Yeah, let me get to that. Let me go back to your question and come back to this.
Okay.
And it's the question of why people don't study it is connected with the people who study it.
Okay.
And, you know, I think in the academic study of religion, much as we like to think otherwise, I think that we still believe that the mind and the ethereal matters more than the body, despite 20 or 30 years of gender analysis, despite body analyses in the academy. And so I think that one of the reasons that people don't study food is because it's too connected to the body, and it's also too connected with something basic. And people still imagine religion to be full of ideas or mystery and that kind of thing. So I think this goes back to this notion, I think, that the scholars are representing particular forms of religion or religious identity. They don't look at other matters. And connected to that, I think, is a lingering sexism in the academy. And I think it's the idea that what women do doesn't matter as much as what men do. I think the very people who would argue the opposite are the ones who would still ignore things like food, raising of children, those kinds of basic things that are very much part of religion. So by giving priority to other matters, we in fact reinforce the gender differential that we're trying to work against. So I think that when you start asking that question, which is a really good question, why people don't study food and religion more than they do, I think it pushes us to some awkward kinds of answers and embarrassing kinds of answers. It's the same as why Protestant Christianity doesn't have or has so few food-related components to it. And I say this, if I can back up a half a step and then continue, I say this in regret in some way, because when I look at when I'm in people's homes in China, I was there a few months ago, and I watch people in the morning make food offerings to their ancestors, reach out to them, and you see this all over the world, and I think, what a profoundly touching way to stay linked to people who belong to your family by reaching out to them with food that you make every day, by reaching out to them at special ceremonies related to the birthdays or other days that are special. So I think that some of the food-related components to religion, the Day of the Dead in Mexico, where people go to the cemetery and they bring food, I think those things are really valuable psychologically, and I think they ground people. And so when I look at their absence in other religions, I think, what a loss that people have given that up. And so I look at, you can't help but ask the questions of what happened exactly. And if you go back to the beginnings of Christianity and you look at Christianity starting up over against Judaism, over against the quote-unquote pagan religions, well, what were those pagan religions? They were full of goddesses, gods. They were talking about family-related matters. They had everything to do with food. So I think part, and I wouldn't want to overgeneralize this, but I think part of Christianity's rejection of the quote-unquote pagan world was a fear of women, a fear of the so-called idol worship, right, of the spirit world generally catching hold. And I think by pulling away from that, what Christianity lost was real earth, human links to life as a way of incorporating those elements into religion. And I think the Protestant tradition, when it responded over against the abuses of Catholicism in the time of the Reformation, it went even further. So the Catholics had kept fasting, they had kept some food restrictions, you know, no meat in certain days. And I think the Protestants, in an attempt to pull away from the horror of horrors, Catholicism, lost some of those really valuable components. And it's a real tragedy. And I've talked to a fair number of Protestants who are trying to recapture that. So Protestants in the U.S. who are getting back into fasting, and who are realizing that this is a way of actually reinforcing their religious tradition. Protestants who feel that sharing food not only with local people but externally is an important part of being Protestant. And I think that's another way of revitalizing what is a Christian tradition that doesn't have to be disconnected from food. So I think from there to ask, well, who is writing about food? Like I say, you have people who are trying to reclaim a focus on that in particular traditions like Judaism and Hinduism. But even in Catholicism, I read the other day a book by a young Hispanic scholar who's now teaching in Mexico City, Angel, what's the name, Mendez Montoya. And he wrote a book called The Theology of Eating, which is all about the Christian Eucharist. And his point is that the Eucharist is all about food, and that God reaches out. It's a theological tract, and he says God reaches out to humans through food, and humans reach out to God through food via the Eucharist, and that to understand theology in any significant way, you have to understand the significance of food and you know, tasting God and smelling God and that kind of thing. And so I think there's going to be more books like that that are going to come out. But for the moment, what you're getting predominantly are studies in Judaism and in Hinduism. Judaism, there's an old book now, but a book called Food and Judaism, edited by a trio of scholars, Greenspoon, Simkins, and Shapiro, which people still read. But there's a lot of articles that are coming out, fun articles and exciting to read, but restricted to Judaism in a way. And there's a lot of articles written in the Hindu tradition that attempt to tell more stories, which are fantastic as well. So a scholar by the name of Banerjee, Chitrita Banerjee, is a great storyteller. The Hour of the Goddess is a good book in which he talks about growing up in Bengal and the traditions of her mother and so forth. So, you know, there's, on the one hand, there's not a lot, but if you scratch a little bit beneath the surface, you'll find people writing about this, that, and the other thing, and the human stories are really vital. I mean, the food traditions that are passed on become so vital in both within religion and outside religion. But since we're talking about religion and food now, let me give you one example. I was invited to a student's house to celebrate Passover with them. So this is a Jewish student. She invited my wife and I to go over. This is in Toronto, an hour away from where I live. And we showed up at the house, and there was the student who was maybe 20 years old and her sister who was a bit younger, the student's mother who probably was in her 40s, and then there was a student's grandmother who was in her 60s. And the grandmother didn't look particularly healthy and was in the kitchen cooking, so of course, I didn't know the family. So at some point, I, you know, sidled over to the grandmother and said, how are you? And you feeling all right? And the grandmother said, well, actually, I was in the hospital this morning. So I said, oh, heavens, what happened? And she says, well, I've been in the hospital for 2 months. And I said, well, what are you doing here today? And she said, well, actually, and she spoke with a little bit of not so much anger, but mock frustration in her voice. And she said, My daughter came in, she stole me from the hospital this morning because she told me that there was this professor who was coming to celebrate Passover, and she didn't remember the recipes for one of the dishes. And I thought, well, how cool is that, right? So you have a family where, and then I asked the students if, you know, my students, if they knew any of the recipes and were doing the cooking, and they didn't. So here you have two 20-somethings who didn't know the cooking traditions, the mother who knew almost all of them, and the grandmother who was the bearer of the wisdom of that tradition. And of course, the hours in the kitchen, and what happened afterwards was the Passover celebration, which was celebrated and led by the man of the house. But the interesting thing is all the preparation and everything on that table had to do with women's work and generations of women's work, not just the one. That's precious. And we're seeing that all across the world. Doesn't matter if you're in Korea or you're in Toronto, what's happening is the younger individuals are not catching on to the traditions, or will catch on in a while when they get married and pregnant and so forth, if they're women. The middle generation is keeping it, and the older generation has a lot more. And so I'm wondering, in 50 years, what all of this is going to look like if the younger generation are not carrying those traditions forward. I think it's not just people in the pews, but it's people in the kitchen who are going to lose some of those traditions.
No, it's interesting. You mentioned that your wife does nutrition.
Yes.
So what about your research related to nutrition? Is there any religion in nutrition research? Like, hopefully that's not a stupid question. I'm just curious if, you know, if there's an association there between certain types of eating and religious tradition. Of course, I know of halal and, you know, keeping kosher and those kinds of things. But what are there other examples of that as well?
It's come up a couple times, Chris. It's come up, it comes up a lot, of course, because her brain is wired that way, so she'll think of that. But it's come up in traditions that are heavily vegetarian, especially the Jain tradition. And so we've had long discussions with Jains about the nutritional value of their food, because as you might know, not only are Jains vegetarian, but they are vegetarians who also don't eat vegetables that grow under the ground, don't eat at certain times of the day, have long fasts. And so the question of the health nature of fasting, what it does to the chemical makeup of your body, same with Ramadan, and the health nature of a diet that restricts a lot of foods quite significantly. She's had a lot of discussions with people and nutritionists within those fields who about the value. And as you might imagine, you know, people who are part of the Jain tradition, who pay attention to their food, will have a nutritious diet, but it's harder to have a nutritious diet. And the really interesting question for Ellen and for us in our research, actually generally, is what happens when those individuals, say, who are coming from Northwest India, who have established over generations a particular way of eating that has become balanced over time by adding little bits of this and little bits of that. What happens when those people immigrate, say, to Canada or the US or the UK? And all of those, you know, the web of interactions is disrupted. And what you get, and Ellen saw this working in public health years ago in Toronto, what you get is nutritional crises at times, because people are merging what they see to be the dominant food traditions here, which tend to be, if you're watching TV and so forth, tend to be very unhealthy, with their food traditions, and the result sometimes leads to really bad nutrition. And so some issues we're having with immigrant groups around the world are ones that have extreme religious dietary restrictions and the nature of that. But there's another example too, which really, really fascinating. It's this issue of food being understood as either hot or cold, and that has nothing to do with temperature. It has to do with the energy heating effect that it has on the body, or on the flattening cooling effect that it has on the body. And in large parts of India and outside of India, people believe, and this is connected to Ayurvedic traditions as well and some yogic traditions, people believe that you have to have a balanced diet. But their sense of balanced diet is not carbohydrates, proteins, and that kind of thing, and fruit and vegetables. it's hot and cold food. And those foods are related to your particular constitution. So if you're stressed at a particular moment in your life, then your body constitution changes. And so somebody who's adept at reading your body will be able to tell you the kinds of foods that you need to eat, more hot foods, more cold foods, in order to make your balanced life. And that's become for us really an interesting phenomenon. If you look at the origins of that, it goes back to ancient Greek times, and it gets picked up because of that. It gets picked up also by the root of Greek tradition and the root of Indian tradition. It's the same as the language, Sanskrit language, right, which is at the base of ancient Greek language and modern Hindi. If you go back to the roots, you find those notions of hot and cold, and they tended to spread to certain countries, like Iran has hot and cold when it comes to food. In the 1600s, when the Europeans, the Spaniards particularly, came to North America, when they came, it was at a particular moment in European history when Europeans thought that hot and cold was the way to understand food. So the Spaniards imported that into their area of domination in Latin America and Central America. And then 100 years later, they changed their mind on that. But part of that importation has continued in some Aboriginal traditions across South America, Central America. So it's really cool to encounter. We were in Guatemala last year. We were talking to people there who had this hot, cold notion. And then the question, go back to nutrition. The question is, how does this affect the nature of nutrition? Like if you're a young Indian woman in Bombay, and again, I'm generalizing, but let's say you're pregnant and your mom says, well, you're pregnant, your body's hotter than it normally is. And so you need to cool it while you're pregnant in order to create more balance. So you want to avoid hot foods. And one of the hot foods is papaya, right? So a young pregnant or a middle-aged pregnant woman in India will be encouraged by her peers often not to eat papaya. And so the question that comes up nutritionally is there any scientific, quote-unquote, legitimation to these kinds of things, right? What's in papaya? And what happens when a woman who's pregnant doesn't get what's in the papaya? And if she's given more cold foods, then what do those foods contain and how is that going to affect the diet? Ellen's a big believer that some of those traditional food notions have value, but in ways that the scientific world doesn't yet understand. So she was always trying to struggle with how do you make sense of, you know, one thing or another. I mean, I'll give you another example of that, and just on this point of hot and cold, we visited Iran a few years ago, and we were put up at a mullah's house, and this was a great honor because no person who was not a Muslim had ever lived or had ever stayed in their house. And the first morning we were there, the mullah's wife prepared this spread for us for breakfast, which we ate on the floor. And it was a whole bunch of little dishes. And I tend not to eat a lot in my meals, which when I'm doing research is often a problem because, you know, you visit people and they give you tons of food and you want to be polite. And but so this woman had laid out this huge spread. And so I ate selectively and I could see that she was upset. And I assumed that she was upset because she had prepared this food. I wasn't eating at all. But it turns out later on, I asked somebody who was at the breakfast and I said, what did I do wrong here? What happened this morning? And the person said, well, you know, she had observed you last night for an hour when you were talking with her husband. And she had read your constitution as being, and I forget whether I was a little too hot or a little too cold or whatever. So she had prepared a breakfast for me, which was intended to balance me that day so that I would leave her house feeling fantastic. And this is a fundamentalist mullah household. This is Islam. She was a good Muslim woman, but she was incorporating into her Islam this, what I would call Aboriginal tradition of hot and cold, right? So her Islam included hot and cold. But I had missed that. It had sailed over my head until I was, you know, made aware that this matters a lot. But that's an example, right, of on a nutritional level. You need to ask the question of, well, okay, so you have a little handful of nuts with your yogurt in the morning. So what does that actually do, right? And that's really fantastic and really, really interesting example to me of once you frame your mind in a different way, food looks differently to you. And it's the same as religion, as you well know. You know, if you imagine the world's going to end next Thursday, you get up in the morning and it's a very different morning than the person next to you who doesn't believe that.
So did you by any chance eat a constitutionally correct breakfast, lunch, or dinner while you were in Iran?
I did. I let myself – well, not everyone who's a cook has that deep knowledge. So some people will not be aware, but the older women we found, and it was mainly women who were making the meals, but the older women are aware of this. So what I did, because, you know, I can't eat too much because I don't feel good, is I would make sure that I selected a little bit from every dish so that at least people felt that I had the balance that was needed. And I found that, you know, if they gave me a dish of something, that of rice that was three times as big as another dish, I would eat three times my little bit of rice than I would the other. So I tried to create the same kind of balance, and I tried to make sure I covered all of the elements. And the people were happy as a result. It was very interesting. But that, again, made me feel like a bit of a barbarian because I thought, for the most part, I was not grown up, or I didn't grow up to appreciate the possibility of seeing food in those ways. And it's the same as other elements of food, isn't it? Because if you grow up and you're told, you know, you shouldn't eat meat because you're a Jain, or you shouldn't eat pork because you're a Jew, or, you know, if you're from outside those traditions, you might think, well, that's kind of silly. Why don't they just, you know, suck it up and eat it? But there's something to be said about imagining yourself in the world as having particular things you can do and things you can't do. And so part of the interest for me as an ethnographer has been to have those conversations with people and try to get into their heads, right? So what's it like being in the world where you imagine that certain things are allowed to you and other things aren't? How does that shape you as a person? Because, of course, it does, right? And a lot of people in the world who are religious have particular food restrictions. And it's one thing that even as a scholar of religion, I didn't appreciate it until I started doing this research.
So I guess to sort of start wrapping things up, what do you see as sort of the future of your research? What do you see sort of your focus going?
Well, Ellen and I have a 200-page draft of our manuscript. So one of the things we want to do is we want to bring to closure the research we've done in order to tell the stories that were told to us, because we've heard so many amazing stories by individuals who, when they're given the chance to talk about the role that food plays in their religious lives, want to talk about it. And so partly we feel a bit like reporters have gone into a state of war, and we're interviewing people who want to get the story out. And so that's the next step for us. And following that is an element that's come out of our research, is that we've discovered by talking to Aboriginal groups in Canada particularly, but we talked to Aboriginal groups in Guatemala a year ago, and we were in the Philippines 3 weeks ago, and we talked to Aboriginals there as well. And it's clear that there are, again, one doesn't want to overgeneralize here, but there are particular ways of understanding links between food and spirituality from Aboriginal contexts. And whenever we tried to do that in Canada alone, there are so many different Aboriginal groups. And I was just at a gathering the other day where they were bringing in the beginning of summer with strawberries, because that's what they always do. So they need the berry, to make the connection with the spirit world and so forth. But, you know, you might go to a community on the west coast of Canada, and they do that with the salmon run, the sockeye salmon run that begins. And so what we want to do is, once we've wrapped up this sort of introductory project for ourselves, is we want to hit the road for a couple of years, maybe not for 24 months, but hit the road and talk to as many Aboriginal peoples as we can on this issue of spirituality and food, as a way partly of extending our work, obviously, but also as a way of becoming more knowledgeable about our own Aboriginal peoples. And one of the reasons we want to do this is because we've learned so much by having conversations about food and religion with people in other traditions and other parts of the world. And we feel that by taking this approach to talking with Aboriginal peoples, that we can't help but benefit from the experience. So we're really looking forward to that as an extension of our work, and in some ways a direct extension, but in some ways it'll lead into other areas. I mean, the Aboriginal front's really fascinating, because another thing we discovered, and I mentioned we were in China a year and a half ago, and we were in southwest China on purpose because of the predominance of Aboriginal groups there that are just so very, very interesting. And there is, in the study of religion, this used to be called animism, right? The imagining the world filled with spirits. But this is everywhere. And you just have to scratch the surface of a religious tradition like Islam or Christianity. You go to Cuba and talk to people involved in Santeria. The quote-unquote animistic worldview is everywhere. And that's predominantly focused on food connections with the spirit world. I mean, spirit's there, but how do you connect to the spirit world, right? And so the Aboriginal connection, which we're thinking of extending in Canada, it comes directly out of discussions that we've had with Aboriginal peoples in other parts of the world. And as I said, that you don't have to scratch much beneath the surface. We were in Java in Indonesia, in a little town, southern part of Java, and we just missed a festival that took place worshiping the sea goddess. So I was sitting down with a person who owned the restaurant there, who was from Germany, and I said, "Tell me about the festival that we just missed." And she says, "Oh, it's a festival that, you know, people gather all their food products, and the main boat has a head of a large bull that's been cut, that's, you know, dripping blood, and they take this stuff out into the ocean and dump it in the ocean because the sea goddess likes it, and the fishing will be better afterwards." And so I said, "Who exactly does this?" And she said, "Well, the people of the village." And I looked, you know, I'd been in the village for a day, and I said, "But these people are all Muslims, aren't they?" And she said, "Well, of course." But she said, "As long as they're back by noon prayers on Friday, it's okay." And I thought, well, holy God. You know, which textbook of Introduction to Islam, again, will tell you this kind of Islam? But that's just one of, you know, dozens of examples we've encountered where, again, you scratch the surface and what you've got is the spirit-based form of spirituality. And it's so predominantly about food. And it's almost as though the dominant traditions, you know, are trying to batter this down as they're going. But they can't, because the vibrancy and the human elements of those things are so strong. So I think, again, if we're going to understand the diversity of religious traditions by honoring that base, if I can call it, of spirit worship, whether it's in Santeria or in Islam or in other forms of Catholicism, food is the way into that, because it's once you see it, it leads you to that lower level, if you can call it the lower level, the base level, which I would see more as foundational as opposed to hierarchically lower. Because it's really on that foundation that these traditions are based. And food is connected to those foundations very much.
I mean, it's really, really interesting to me. I mean, growing up, of course, I grew up in the Southeast United States, and just about anybody knows me, I wear that on my shoulder everywhere I go. But it's funny, like here, I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and we have more heart doctors per capita than anywhere else in the world. And part of it has to do with sort of the cultural and geographic norms of this area, and that, you know, a lot of people eat fried food. But then you just go 20 minutes up the road from Chattanooga to a place called Collegedale, Tennessee, and it's this massive Seventh-day Adventist community. And restaurant after restaurant just has, you know, vegetarian options, very healthy options. And so it's like all the contrast, you know, sort of the, I guess you sort of call it the mosaic of diets that exist in a place like this.
Yes. And so, that's an example. The Seventh-day Adventist example is one of, it's a kind of quirky example, right? So you're in the middle of the 19th century in America, and the slaughterhouses are utterly disgusting, and people are getting sick when they eat meat. So you have, you know, Ellen G. White, who wants her community to honor the body being the body that God's created, the body of Christ, and so forth, and so encourages her people to be vegetarian. So again, it comes out of a particular place, and you end up with a community that still today is predominantly vegetarian. And you know, when it comes to nutrition, those people are studied in California, in the northern part of the States, and it's a healthy diet. They live longer, et cetera, et cetera. So fascinating that that Christian component should have come out of such a kind of idiosyncratic base. I mean, in sure. Canada, we have another group called the Dukhobors, mm-hmm. who came out of Russian Orthodoxy. They were a pacifist group, and of course, being pacifist, everyone tried to kill them. You know how those
things are. Yeah, exactly.
And at the end of the 19th century, one of their leaders decided to become vegetarian as a way of honoring the pacifistic nature of their principles. And so they've kept that vegetarian lifestyle. Not everyone is vegetarian, who's Dukhobor, but most of them are. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them moved to Canada. And so in western parts of Canada, we have large communities of Dukhobors who are Christians, right? But they're vegetarians. And again, a quirky kind of place because it doesn't naturally fit in the broader context of Christianity.
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, Chattanooga is not exactly a very large town. You've been here. But at the same time, you know, we do have a Muslim community. We have a Hindu community. And sort of trying to gain availability to certain kinds of foods, you know, even when you're – I mean, we're not isolated, but, you know – well, you could say parts of Tennessee were very much isolated as much as little as 30 years ago. And, you know, and it's funny how globalization also plays a big component into this as well. So,
well, one of the struggles, I would think, in a place like Tennessee is you have a tradition, for instance, of Southern barbecues.
Right.
And you have a big tradition of eating pork. And
right.
Yeah. Those two things are foundational to that part of the world.
Right.
So when you get people coming in from outside for whom pork is restricted meat, mm-hmm. you know, you have two things clashing. Even with the best of intentions, you have a community that really wants to say, look, if you move here, then get used to pork. And then you've also got a community of Muslims for whom pork might be just a horrible thing even to be in close to. So how do you develop dialogue between two groups of people on those particular issues? I find even in my own community at the university, that professes to be open to the global world, that professes to be open to every community. We have flags of the world flying now above our cafeteria. And it's taken me years of discussions with food services here to get across to them the pork, which is also locally grown here, and farmers have a lot of, you know, respect for what they do. But to get across the point that if we're going to honor the presence of a diverse group of students, that some students are not going to feel comfortable with pork. So why don't we, if we can do otherwise, why don't we serve beef or even better, chicken, right? Or even better still, more vegetarian. But the really interesting thing for me is that I've been talking with people about this. On virtually any other issue I would have talked to them about, they would have understood. But on this food issue, it's like a wall because people are not used to understanding or appreciating the significance of the deep significance of food for individuals, especially people who don't have strong food traditions in their own religions or people who are no longer religious. Right, who tend to be, you know, even if they won't say it publicly, they tend to be looking down on religious people. So religious people who have food restrictions, they'll look down on them even more, right? Because those idiots should get over that. And so it's difficult to open up those conversations between groups that are very secular and groups for whom food and religion matter profoundly. And to me, that's a challenge, which I think as a Canadian, living in a country that values multiculturalism, it's a challenge that we've not yet faced and that we need to face in the years to come.
Well, and it's funny, too, you know, being in this cultural context, you'll have, for example, we just had a major music festival here in town, and they do one of the days, there's a celebration of African-American heritage called the Bessie Smith Strut, which they closed down an entire street of Martin Luther King Boulevard, and it's huge deal. And it's very multicultural, multiracial, and I mean, it's amazing. It's like a part of town that most people wouldn't want to go to normally because of concerns of safety or gang activity gets transformed for a day. And then on top of that, this is what's so amazing to me, is that our Muslim community here in town will host a barbecue that's halal friendly. You know, and it's interesting, you know, because there's a large number of African Americans who, of course, are Muslim. And so it's some of the best barbecue at the place. I mean, you know, so it's interesting, those kind of social negotiations that occur. And, of course, I'm pointing to my hometown, but I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of those around the world where those negotiations occur, and, you know, sharing of space and, you know, and food, I think, in some ways is, of course, you know, I think you're onto something. I wouldn't have asked you to be in this interview, but I think food in some ways is that one last personal piece of space in some ways, you know, not just religious, but even just sharing a meal with somebody is a very personable experience. So.
I think you're right. And the example you give, if I can just add to that, I think, you know, I hear people often talk about interreligious dialogue and, you know, all the better if people do that and so forth. But my experiences of those is they don't work very well because, you know, you get people in the room who are lefties who want to talk to each other and they go away but nobody else engages. But I think when you get people together over food, like this Muslim group who are doing halal barbecues, I think there's much more a potential for people to learn from one another through eating and sharing, an intimate kind of space, than blah, blah, blahing about whether Jesus is the same as Muhammad or whatever, right? That's going to get you nowhere. But the halal barbecues will get you somewhere.
Sure. And you're sharing space, you're sharing a meal. I mean, it's profound. It's a really profound experience. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, we're definitely out of time, but let me just say this has been a fascinating interview. I'm really interested in your research. I appreciate you taking the time, Dr. Desjardins, to enlighten us on religion and food. This was great.
Thanks to Chris Silver and Michel Desjardins there for that fantastic interview. And now, as I said last week, I think this interview was slightly longer than many of ours are usually, so we shouldn't talk too long here and out at the end, but... I think it was worth having in its entirety. I didn't want to cut anything out of it.
Brilliant.
Interesting chap. Next week is the final one of our religion and cultural production series. We had Carol Cusack's on the notion of cultural production.
Mm-hmm.
And we followed that up with
Pauline Hope Chung.
Social media, and then we had neoliberalism and consumer culture. That's had food, and next week we've got comic books.
Comic books,
not going to say anything about this bit because you're the comic book guy.
No, I'm the conspiracy guy.
But
I happen to know a little bit about comics.
Yes, you have a comic book hat that you can.
I can whip that on, So I'm very excited about this. A. David Lewis was the co-editor of Graven Images, which was the first major publication on comic books and religious studies. And it was the first book I reviewed, and it was my first academic publication. I think. Certainly the first one to come out. And I have also organised the response to this from my friend Sean Jeffries, who has just submitted his PhD in comic books and transhumanism.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, okay.
So he's a kind of mixing religious, technological, cultural ideas there. So it'll be interesting to see what he's got to say, because I think there were some specifically religious themes that came up in his thesis that he wasn't able to go too deeply into, so we'll see what he makes of it.
Brilliant.
Finish up with our usual stuff, really. We don't have too much news.
Yeah, let's
that
do
way.
That.
We are presented in association with the BASR, the British Association for the Study of Religions, to whom we are forever grateful. So do check them out and remember them. In your wills and things like that.
And whilst remembering things and perhaps buying
items to add to your will. You might want to use our Amazon link, which will give us a small percentage of what you spent on Amazon without any additional cost to yourself, helping the project whilst helping yourself.
Yeah, and this has been running since January. We've had this, and we just got our first payment from Amazon last week. So that was delightful. But we know that we can do better. We can do better. People
can always do better.
Get on with it. Facebook page is increasing as ever in the number of likes that it has. We've got a good Twitter following as well. We have just ventured into Google+, and we are, of course, still on iTunes. So remember all of that stuff.
All of those, and if you're using us on iTunes, if you're accessing us through iTunes, please do give us a rating. Something as simple as that. If we get enough 5-star ratings, that could put us onto the front page of iTunes and double our audience overnight. So it might seem like nothing to you, but in aggregate, these things really count.
And it matters for the discipline, people, not just for the podcast, for the discipline.
That's right.
I think all I've got to say, David, is the usual.
Thanks for listening.